Hello and welcome to Radio EduTalk. This is David Noble in Dalgety Bay, and I'm delighted to welcome to the show this evening Anna Kennedy, OBE, and we're going to be talking about inclusion and equality of children with an autism spectrum condition. Welcome to Radio EduTalk, Anna.
Hello there, thank you for inviting me.
And just to start off with, could you give listeners a kind of brief background to your life and how you came about to set up AKO, Anna Kennedy Online website?
I have two sons who are on the autism spectrum. You probably can hear my youngest son, Angelo, in the background. My eldest son, Patrick, is 27. He's got a diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome. And my youngest son, Angelo, is 24 and he's got a diagnosis of autism, a sensory processing condition and nocturnal epilepsy. And both my boys were diagnosed. And what happened was when it was time for Angelo to start school, the school said that they couldn't meet his needs, so he didn't have a place. And my eldest son, Patrick, at the age of 7, was finding it really difficult in school. For about 3 years, we really struggled with him, trying to get him into school. And he just wasn't settling at all and became very anxious and was sleepwalking and just wasn't settling at all. So we ended up with two boys at home, basically just getting 5 hours home tuition from the local authority. And the lady that was working with Patrick was great. We ended up employing her when we set up our own school. And the other lady that was working with Angelo had never worked with a child with autism and was just totally out of her comfort zone and didn't know what to do. So basically what I was doing was reading a lot, which is what parents do as soon as their children have been diagnosed with autism. Once they've got through the shock and trying to get their head around it, then you start looking for information and, you know, what is autism and how is it going to affect my son or my daughter. So you almost become like a boffin, if you like, because you want to try and get as much information as you possibly can on what you can do to help your son or daughter. Because basically a lot of parents, once their children have been diagnosed, no one actually sits down with them and tells them what autism is, you know, that, you know, is it a lifelong disability? You know, at first I'd had never heard of it at all. And I thought, well, is it a disease? How long have they got to live? But then when you read more and more about it, you learn that it's a spectrum. No two children are the same. You've got quite severe children at one end of the spectrum with no speech whatsoever, very much in their own world with overlapping conditions. And then you've got other children that have what they say is at the higher end of the spectrum, or they might have a diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome. They may not have a learning disability. So it's real, real minefield of trying to get your head around, you know, what does this mean for my child? What does it mean for the family? And then what can I do to support them as best possible so that they can basically get on in life just like everybody else? And then once you start going through the system, it's really quite complicated and you really need to get your head around it. It's almost like a different language. You know, first of all, you know, you start looking through reports that you receive, and then you see words like SALT, you see words like OT. And if you're not familiar with those words, you think, well, what are they? And then you later on down the line learn that SALT as a speech and language therapist, or OT is for occupational therapy. So it's a real big learning curve, learning the system, learning how to navigate it, but also then dealing with what's going on at home. It may be that your child might be a poor sleeper, like both my boys were, or you know, maybe they're anxious, or it's just lots of things to get your head around. And then just to try and support your children as best you can through quite a complicated system. And then obviously trying to go to work. It's just that, you know what I mean? It's just you're just doing whatever you can to help your family function as well as possible, but trying to support the children and also the siblings if you have them.
And at what stage then did you consider setting up, you know, Anna Kennedy Online? And can you then tell us about, you know, what the kind of aims or purposes are of the website?
Yeah, well, it started off by first setting up a school and then a college as my boys got older. And then in 2009, 2010, parents started writing to me about difficulties that they had with trying to get a diagnosis, trying to find the right type of school, what provision was available, just wanting to chat, just wanted to chat to someone that was going through the same things that they'd been through. So that's why I set up Anna Kennedy Online, which is a charity that supports families, gives advice, but also what we're trying to do is create opportunities for young individuals. And I've gone into the world of performing arts, and I sort of went into the world of performing arts by accident, really, because I went to see a show. I was invited by Pineapple Performing Arts. And then parents started to write to me about children and adults that, you know, that they wanted to get into the world of the performing arts. They might be great at singing, dancing, playing the piano, a comedian, magicians. And they were basically, a lot of their children were being bullied, and they turned to the performing arts to help them get through their ordeal. So hence, that's how Autism's Got Talent was born, through Anna Kennedy Online. And now we're in our seventh year. And it's such an amazing show, and it's created so many opportunities for young individuals, and also increased their confidence, making friends, and also families getting to know each other. And from Autism's Got Talent, it's also developed into a roadshow. So I've taken it to the Northeast. We've just recently been in Essex. Next year, we're going to Liverpool. And from Autism's Got Talent, other things have basically spiraled out, as in creating an album, mainly of individuals on the autism spectrum, where they've written their own songs. The individual that put it together, Aaron, he had his own recording studio. I wanted something that was created purely by people on the autism spectrum. And now we're in the process of, we've created a single where we're going to share it next week, which is really exciting, by a young man called Macaulay Elvin. Who is going to be, he's written the words to the song, and basically it's to help create more awareness about bullying. And we have a campaign that we've been working on for the last, about 5-6 years now, and it's called Give Us a Break. We work with the NSPCC in the past, we've worked with Anti-Bullying Alliance, and now we're again working to raise awareness through performing arts, if you like. And this young man doesn't want other children and adults to be bullied as he was, so hence why he's created this song, and we're very excited to share it next week.
That's great, and yeah, and hopefully all schools around the country will be involved in to whatever degree in the Anti-Bullying Week. I'm wondering about the virtual community within the website. We had a guest on a few weeks ago who was talking about young people that had a certain difficulty within school, and that very often they felt left down. And so it was that whole idea of kind of self-help and community help. Does that sound similar to your own experiences then with parents and families?
Yeah, most definitely. I think social media can be a fantastic tool, but it can also be not such a good place. So what we've created, if you like, through Facebook, through Twitter, through Instagram, and through our charity website, is somewhere where parents can share information, where adults themselves can share information. I post every single day on social media, sharing maybe experiences that I might be going through with my own son, so people don't feel as if they're alone, or sharing information or sharing strategies. And then everybody else sort of pitches in what works for them, what didn't work for them. Have you heard about this? Have you heard about this respite facility? Have you heard about this play scheme? Because it's very much, a lot of it is by word of mouth, but also by searching, and people ask for have you attended this play scheme, and what has it been like, you know, is it suitable for children with autism? So basically we've created a community where everyone's supporting each other and sharing information, which is fantastic, because then people don't feel alone and don't feel isolated. Like, for example, this evening, The A Word is on BBC One. It's the second series. I saw the first programme because I was invited to the premiere. So I shared what I thought of it. And so parents are going to be watching it tonight. And, you know, some parents might think it's great. Some parents might not think it's so great, because it doesn't really represent what they're going through at home. But do you know what? It's great as a talking point. So you're never going to please everybody, but it's great to spark conversation so that people are talking about autism. They are trying to raise awareness about autism. And the biggest thing for people and families on who have children with autism, they just want acceptance, and they want to have opportunities created so that they can make their mark in the world just like everybody else.
And we also had the Chris Packham programme recently, and that's one that I'm hoping to watch this evening.
Yeah, it's amazing. I really, really thought that was very well put together. It's definitely worth a watch. I won't spoil it for you, but it's really something that I think that it really shows very well, you know, what he's gone through as a child, what he's going through as an adult at the moment. And it touches on lots of different topics. And I think it was very well put together. It probably took quite a bit of time to put together, but I think it was really great. And there's more programs now about autism. You know, The Good Doctor is another one that there's a lot of positivity around that. But then there's also a few sort of negative comments, because then the way it's been portrayed, it's almost like that the doctor's got like a special gift or a special talent, which is something that a lot of parents obviously feel a little bit that, you know, that's not what autism is about. That's not how it represents itself, even though the individuals have got their strengths.
And just going back to kind of the experiences of young people and families within the school system, can you say a bit more about, you know, the kind of particular difficulties and the extent to which, you know, mainstream and other types of education provision are meeting needs? I mean, I know from a teacher's point of view, you know, myself as a teacher and many listeners are teachers as well, that very often they say that they really sense, getting to know certain young people well, that they may be on the autism spectrum, but that the young person's possibly nowhere near getting an actual diagnosis. But what other kind of problems exist?
We did a survey about how long it took for parents that were trying to get a diagnosis for their children or their adults. And for the point of, there was 10 questions we asked, and it was like, when did you first notice? You know, how was the process? How long did it take? What happened after the diagnosis? So we did it about 4 years ago, and there was 2,000 families across the country that completed the survey. And on average, parents were waiting 5 years for a diagnosis. There was many others that were waiting sort of 10 years, 12 years, 15 years that had slipped through the system. But this is obviously going to have an impact on the family. It's going to be difficult for teachers at the school because they're not knowing what they're dealing with. So it very much depends on where you live. It's very much a postcode lottery. Some parents, you know, can get a diagnosis within 6 months and a year, and I think it's acceptable 6 months, but definitely not 5 years, because then that's when bullying might take place. So it just really impacts on the family. My husband, Sean, he's a barrister, and he works with an awful lot of families that are trying to get their children into the right schools or trying to get the right type of provision. And he's with me actually at the moment, and he can talk to you about the difficulties because he works with a lot of local authorities. So he's just coming onto the phone now, if that's okay.
Yeah, that's great, Anna. Thank you very much.
Sean, we're just talking to David, and we're talking about difficulties that family have with trying to get their children into special schools, and, you know, what sort of difficulties are you coming across where families are really fighting or spending an awful lot of money to try and get reports so that their children can get the right type of support within schools?
Hello.
Hi, Sean.
Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hello. I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very well, thanks. Can you take us through the kind of difficulties that families are facing then?
Well, essentially, I think that, I know they are in Scotland, and the situation, the system is slightly different there, but it's similar. If you want to get the provision for your child, then you need to, it's an evidence-based approach. So you have to get the evidence to justify that provision being put in. In England, it's an educational health and care plan. In Scotland, I think it's a coordinated support plan or something, isn't it? So, which is something
it's
the same thing but with a different name. Yeah. So in the relevant section, say in section F, you would need your special educational provision. So that would be have to be an evidence based approach taken. So you'd have to get a relevant expert to recommend the provision. And you're finding that when local authorities actually draft plans, the evidence just isn't available. So a lot of parents are having to procure the evidence of their own from their own independent experts. So, and that's a costly exercise. So therefore, children's needs are really not being met. But I mean, you can work backwards as well, that I find that in a lot of cases that children's needs are not correctly identified either. So that's a double-edged sword, because if the needs are not identified, then the provision's not going to be made available. But I mean, you were, I know you're interested in equality, the Equality Act, I believe, is something that you were focusing on in this program. Mm-hmm. Well, this is slightly, the Equality Act, of course, is slightly different. If, I mean, do you mind me just mentioning that?
No, absolutely, that, Sean, on you go. Yeah, that'd be really helpful.
Yeah, the Equality Act. Well, of course, this is a bit easier, because the Equality Act is applies to the United Kingdom, so which of course includes, well, for now anyway, Scotland. And that, for obviously, people with autism would have the protected characteristic of disability. Now, the Equality Act applies to schools, of course, and it means it applies to every aspect of a school with the exception of the curriculum, if you like. So it might apply to disciplinary procedures, school outings, the way things are arranged in the school. But although the Equality Act provides a lot of protection, I'm finding that it's very rarely implemented. Now, the main provision of the Equality Act is reasonable adjustments, which is something a lot of people have heard of. And if there's an aspect of a school that is difficult for a person who has a disability, which obviously would include could include autism, then reasonable adjustments have to be made to reduce the disadvantage that they're experiencing because of the effect of their disability. Unfortunately, and this applies not only to schools, but to Clause 16 provisions and even universities. And unfortunately, the whole idea of reasonable adjustments is just not understood. And it applies more widely, of course, not just in education, but in service provision. So whenever a person with autism, so it could be an adult, it could be a child, with disadvantage because of the effects of their disability, and it's there's a service being provided, then the provider really has to make reasonable adjustments to remove that disadvantage. And that's a tremendously powerful structure that assists people with autism. But unfortunately, it's just not well understood. And there is a mechanism for enforcing it in schools, but again, it's not really well understood, or certainly not implemented. And then, of course, in employment, employers are under a duty to make reasonable adjustments. Again, I find time and time again, not with people with autism, but in people with all disabilities, employers are quite reluctant, or they just don't understand what their duties are. And of course, the person with the disability is disadvantaged. They maybe can't do the job. They get accused of not having the capability of doing a job. Gets very frustrating, which is why employment levels for people with disabilities are so low in this country. When I say in this country, I'm talking about the United Kingdom, you see. So it's quite frustrating. I don't know what you know, what the experience in Scotland is, but I'm pretty sure from the evidence I've seen, it mirrors the rest of the United Kingdom.
And Sean, just before we go, maybe go back to Anna, you know, that sounds like a pretty hopeless situation, but where, you know, if there's families listening to the show tonight, you know, where would they go as a first port of call to try and challenge or trying to enforce the Equality Act?
The Equality Act, well, I think the first port of call, you know, there is a, you can use the, shall we say, the court system to enforce your rights. However, that's potentially expensive, it's time-consuming, can be quite frustrating and quite stressful. So I would actually say the first thing I would do if I had a, and we're talking about a child here with a disability, I'd look at some of the resources available on, the Commission for Equality of Human Rights website, Commission for Equality of Human Rights website. I think there's the same one in Scotland. And they've got a lot of easily accessible guidance that tells you about the rights available to disabled people, not only in education, but in all manner of service provision. And if you came up against a problem, my first protocol would be actually to go to the provider and say, you know what, my son, my daughter, maybe a child, maybe an adult, they're disadvantaged because of the way you organize things. Yeah? I'd say, can you make an adjustment and change things? And you'll be surprised. The number of people who provide a service in shops, etc., they're quite amenable if you have a reasonable conversation with them. And, you know, that's usually a useful part of, usually a useful first step. And that can reduce an awful lot of frustration. Obviously, it leads to greater inclusion of the disabled person, the disabled child, or the disabled adult. I think that would be my first protocol.
That's really helpful, Sean. And am I right in saying that yourself and Anna work closely together on the actual website, the AQO website?
Yes, we get a lot of. A lot of the content is Anna's. Anna and her, you know, other people who support the charity. I get a lot of queries from people, often in the education / disability field, more and more in employment, which is, you know, unfortunately, it's still a fact of life. But I mean, one thing I would like to say, just picking up on the last point, something in England that there is, and I apologise for my ignorance if I don't know what it's called in Scotland, but if you're about to get a job, there's something called Access to Work, which is run by the Department of Work and Pensions, I think, and that is a fund that's available to provide adjustments for disabled people when they gain employment. Now, again, I do apologise. I don't know the mechanism in Scotland, but it certainly exists in England. I am pretty sure it exists in Scotland. And I'm sure someone with more familiarity would be able to give more detail. But they're very, very helpful. And I remember I spoke to one of the people who administers this, and he said it's the best kept secret in the country. So there is a fund available for people who want to get into employment. And it can help firms with making the adjustment. Then it could be getting a specialist in to advise, getting specialist equipment in. So, yeah, so there is help out there. So it's admittedly not as good as what we would like. But, you know, there are avenues for support out there. And generally speaking, you know, people don't want to discriminate against a disabled person. Would you agree?
No.
They don't want to consciously or intentionally do it.
Absolutely, Sean.
So therefore, you know, a little bit of gentle prodding can go a long way.
Now, my understanding, and other people could come in after tonight's show is finished, but I do believe that Access to Work does apply in Scotland. The opportunities there for the, as I think Inclusion Scotland say, the a government scheme that pays for practical support and adjustments in the workplace. So I believe it is throughout the United Kingdom. Sean, thank you so much for joining us on the show. I'm just wondering if you could pass back on to Anna just to get some kind of final links that listeners could go to get more information.
I certainly will, and it was lovely speaking to her. I will just go and get her, and I'll certainly be listening to your show with interest from now on.
Hello there, David.
Hi, Anna. That was really interesting from Sean, and I'm sure that listeners will be really interested with some of the kind of practicalities and possible support and potential avenues that they or friends or family members can go down. So that was excellent. Time's got the better of us, Anna, and I just wonder if we could finish up with your own thoughts in terms of where do people go to get more information. And I would just like to say, you know, your website's excellent, and I really enjoyed having as somebody who's into social media and blogging and podcasting, it's great to come across a website where the blog is so actively used and kind of written to by many different contributors. So that's a place within the website I would really recommend listeners to go to. Where else would you recommend?
Obviously, there's the national organisations that you can contact. Twitter and Facebook are great. There's lots of groups out there where people have either created closed groups, or if you want to talk privately, I know a gentleman has just created a dad's group, because there's lots of stuff out there for the mums, but he wanted to create something where it was just for dads, where they just wanted to have a private group. So it's called Hillingdon Dads. So if there's any dads out there, and even though it's called Hillingdon Dads, it's actually for dads across the country. So that's a great place where just men, or fathers can, or grandfathers can just talk about what they want to talk about. As I say, social media is great. You can look on our website, Anna Kennedy Online, share any information, or you can share any of the information that I share. I'm on Facebook, Anna Kennedy Online. I've got my own personal Facebook, Anna Kennedy, and then Anna Kennedy again on Twitter. So another place I would say is probably a good one is Ipsia. There's templates of letters there that you can use if you're going through the process of trying to find the right type of school. There's lots of templates of letters on there that are really useful. So another one is ICANN, which is a great website if your child might have autism and significant speech and language difficulties. There's lots of good groups out there, and there's a lot of smaller groups as well that are working just as hard as these bigger national charities. And I always say on Charity Tuesday, don't forget about the smaller groups, because they work just as hard and they also need the funding as well.
Just before you leave us, Anna, just a kind of final thought from you, if you don't mind, in terms of where we need to go, what kind of awareness needs to be raised, what things need to change in the coming years to improve the situation for young people and families.
I think what parents need to do is really learn the system. Like, so wherever it is that you are, you need to learn the system of your particular area where you are, so you almost become an expert, because a lot of the time, a lot of the documents that are written, say, might come from the local authority, it's written in a way that benefits them and not benefit the family, if you like. A lot of the parents don't understand the jargon that's inside say, for example, it used to be the statement, and it used to say things like regular speech and language therapy. Well, if the child receives speech and language therapy once a year, that's regular. So it needs to be very specified. It needs to be quantified. Speak to other people as well who have gone through the system, and then they can tell you where the pitfalls are. One other thing I would say is never give in. If you don't speak up for the rights of your child, who else is going to do it for you? So, you need to almost become like an expert on the system, and then really fight for the rights where you feel your child. It doesn't matter, they say they haven't got the money to fund it, they have to find it from somewhere. So I would say, if you feel one particular school is right for your child, I always say go with your gut instinct as well. Visit as many schools as you possibly can, whether they're special educational needs schools, whether they're mainstream schools, whether they're units. Get a real picture for what's going on around you. And I'm very much of a person where I go with my gut instinct, and it usually really serves me well. Look at Ofsted reports when you're looking at schools as well. Have a look to see what sort of ratings they got. So just really sort of do your research well, and then you'll have done the best that you possibly can to try and find the right place, whether it's a school, whether it's a college, whether it's trying to find a work placement for your son or your daughter. Always do your research and try and speak to as many people as you possibly can, and as I say, just fight for everything. I always say you can either give up, give in, or give it all you've got and then some.
And what about for the kind of education leaders? We talked about the long time to get a diagnosis. So what about for education leaders who are working with young people who haven't yet received a diagnosis? What kind of good practices and mindsets really should exist?
Well, hopefully the diagnosis process is going to not take as long. They're talking about trying to make the system a lot shorter so that parents don't have to wait as long. But I'm sure that there's a lot of schools out there that have got expertise where, they've they've taught so many children with autism, then they may have an inkling that that child may be on the autism spectrum. So I'm sure that they can put some resources in place to support that child during play times, during lunch times is the most difficult time for a lot of the children, and it can impact on their whole day because they're worrying about what's going to be happening at playtime, what's going to be happening at lunchtime. So what I was suggesting was that in the last few years we talk about, you know, a lot of schools are doing it now, but lunchtime clubs can really support the child because it, then it gives it a little bit more of a structured time. We went into one particular school in Croydon, and they didn't have any lunchtime clubs at all. And after we gave the talks and we spoke about lunchtime clubs, they had about 45 students at the school. And then the next day, quite a few of the students actually knocked on the head teacher's door and said, we want these lunchtime clubs that Anna Kennedy's talking about because we're really struggling at lunchtime. They never, ever had said anything before. And now they've got something like 40 to 45 clubs that are going on, and they're constantly changing. And a lot of the older children are supporting the younger children. It not only benefits kids with autism, but other children that have got special educational needs. So I would say try and support the family and listen to them as much as you possibly can, because I think parents can become mini experts on their own children because they know what it's like for them day to day. They know what triggers can be that can cause anxiety. So it needs to be a partnership working together.
That's great advice, Anna. Thank you so much for taking time out this evening to join us on EduTalk. I'm sure there'll be many people downloading and streaming the audio from tonight's show in the coming weeks, and we'll be to forward any comments or questions on to you. So thanks again, and it's an open invitation for you to come on sometime in the future.